Board of Commissioners in order.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please join me for a moment of prayer. Heavenly Father, we come to you today asking for your blessing upon the activities here this afternoon. Pray that you give the leaders of this county wisdom. We pray for everyone here that we might have unity in our endeavors here in this county to move Brown County forward. We thank you for all the blessings you've poured out on us, for the beautiful place you gave us. And we also have to remember those who are at war, those who are suffering from these terrible tragedies we've had, from this hurricane. We pray that you'd help us to be good stewards of the things we have and to help those around us. And we pray you'd be with those who suffer. Just now we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Okay, are there any additions or changes to the agenda?
Do we want to talk anything about the veterans' bill? We move forward with it because if we get the 11% discount, it can save us almost $500.
Okay, if you say go, then I have all three of you saying go.
Yeah, okay. Understanding, let's just put that on the agenda and we'll talk about it.
Yeah, we need to move it.
Correct.
I think they've got a pretty good building to do their take care of their needs and comes in a box that I've put together to agree to do that. Appreciate that. Okay, anything else?
I can't think of anything at the moment.
Okay. Have you gentlemen had a chance to look at the claims in the minutes?
I have.
Entertain a motion.
I make a motion to approve the minutes and claims.
Second.
Motion to second. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor, raise your right hand and say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Moving to old business, the Brixton Courthouse. Get an update from Blake on that and the status of the Bell project.
Well, everything is going swimmingly, as they say, and by virtue of our excellent highway superintendent, they were down there, they dug today and got that going. And if you don't mind, I wouldn't mind having Dwayne come up and giving just a quick synopsis of what where we're at on this. Come up and you've been on this since the get go, so I'm gonna let you be in the lurch here on this.
Yeah, Dwayne Parsons, Brown County. We broke ground this morning. Yeah, with the help of a lot of people, it's been 5 years and 4 months since we started this project, and we finally put a shovel in the ground today. For the ones that you don't know, we took the bell out of the tower of the courthouse 5 years ago, and which a lot of people didn't even know we had a bell. I wasn't aware of it. It's a big bronze bell, and we're going to display it on the courthouse lawn under a shelter for everybody to see and be quite a tourist draw, we hope. And I'd like to thank everybody that so far has been helping us and donated. And we are, Blake can tell you more about the bricks. We're doing it in engraved pavers. We're selling the bricks to go around it. And if you want a brick, you need to get on the list. They're $100 a piece, and they're selling fairly quick, I think.
They are selling quick.
So, and that should generate somewhere around $30,000 to $40,000 in tax-free, free money. We like free. Thank you.
Thanks, Dwayne. So we're very happy that that's going well, and like he said, what we're planning on doing is taking the bricks. We were going to put them in the blanks that we had where we fixed the walkway, but now I think it was going to go around the bell, and it's going to be awesome, and I know the judge and everybody that's been involved in this is just tickled, and so it's just one more thing. It's going to make, you know, your trip to Brown County a little bit more pleasant, so, you know. More on that later. We do have a list going if you want to get on it. We're trying to get everybody so that they can do one-time laying of the brick, because, you know, you can't have part of it because it's a safety issue. But so get it in, and yeah, looking good. Thanks.
Okay, very good. Okay, we'll move on. Before we have a guest speaker today, Commissioner needed to discuss the additional holiday that we have requested from employees. They got three extra holidays this year, actually because of the election, with two, and then we had the eclipse, which turned out to be a non-event for Brown County. But anyway, we were glad we didn't have any problems from it. So anyway, they've requested an additional holiday, and we discussed this in a meeting before last, and we kind of talked about some different options, and since then we've received a lot of input. I want to say first of all that you have three commissioners sitting up here who all have run as Republicans on a Republican Party ticket. And our founder, the founder of our Republican Party, was Abraham Lincoln. And Abraham Lincoln, as you know, was the one who freed the slaves, if you will. And Juneteenth, as I understand it, is the day, 19th of June in 1867, which when the last slaves were freed.
65.
I stand corrected. So I want to revisit that, and I understand the concern. There's no racism here amongst us. We simply were looking at an additional holiday, and it turns out that Juneteenth became part of the discussion, and instead of adopting that name for our additional holiday, we adopted something else. So we're going to back up and we're going to correct that. I absolutely have the greatest respect for people of different races and national origins. I roomed with a black man in college. We were great friends. I've never held any ill feelings towards anybody because of their race or their nationality. In fact, I welcome other viewpoints. And in fact, I went so far as to marry a woman from Colombia, South America, who speaks Spanish and is a bit of a different race and national origin, being a Latino. So I have no feelings like that. So I'm going to entertain a motion for us to alter the holiday calendar, which I think we adopted at that meeting, and go back and revise that and put Juneteenth on there as a Brown County recognized holiday. We normally follow the state's lead, and I checked the state's calendar. They do not have it on their calendar for 24 or 25. However, the governor did make a proclamation about the 19th of June this year, and I'm sure in time they will. It is a national holiday, but we've normally followed the state's lead, but this time we're going to go one better than that. And not only is it going to be declared a holiday, we're giving our employees a day off, which is a lot of federal agencies do or don't, and the state many times does or doesn't give people time off and such things. But at this point in time, I'd entertain a motion to re-adopt the calendar and include Juneteenth as a holiday in Brown County and for a day off for our Brown County employees.
I'd like to be the one to make the motion.
Okay.
I'd actually like to say something.
Go right ahead.
Just a little bit.
Sure.
Yeah, it was June 19, 1865. And the Union soldiers went in and freed the last of the slaves in Texas. That was actually created when Abraham Lincoln made the Emancipation Proclamation. And that was in September the 22nd of 1862. And in 1863, in January, is when it was put into law. But it still took 2 years, almost 2 years, to get them out. Texas is actually, I believe, the first state that made it a state paid holiday. Now, I'm not educated as much as some people. I want to say that I personally apologize to anybody that was offended from this. How that ended up happening was we was looking at something called Old Settlers Team, which actually the first one we had here in the county was on September the 22nd. That's the beginning of autumn, okay? And that was in 1877. So something about the date, it got mixed in. A lady in the audience stepped up from the Brown County Community Foundation and said, instead of doing that, why don't you call it Brown County Employee Appreciation Day? Okay? It seemed like a better idea at the time. It was somewhat of a compromise, but we're not perfect up here. We make mistakes. And honestly, we made a big one here. So with that said, I'd like to make a motion that we change it to June 19th, call it Juneteenth, and still have the paid holiday so the employees get them. I'd actually thought about giving the employees one more day on September the 22nd, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to leave it alone because I think it costs like $22,000 a day.
We'll work harder that week.
Well, we can revisit that later. But I make a motion that we change the Brown County Employee Appreciation Day on the 19th of June from 2025 to Juneteenth.
Okay, I have a motion, and I'd like to second that motion as well. And then I'd open it for discussion, and we vote. Is anything anybody else would like to say? I guess, otherwise. All in favor, raise your right hand and say aye.
Aye.
All right. Now we have a lady here who's going to give a short presentation on the very subject. And I think she's right in here in the audience. Yes. Eunice Trotter, right?
You might have to turn that mic on.
Yeah, it's on.
It's on?
Hello, hello.
Okay.
Okay, we're getting the technology set up here so that I can get to the first screen. And that is taking place, I just want to thank the commission for allowing me this opportunity to come to this beautiful, beautiful community or this beautiful day and just be a part of this beautiful celebration, because what you're doing here is going to make Brown County shine. I don't know of any other county in the state that has recognized Juneteenth as a holiday. Indiana does not recognize Juneteenth as a holiday. However, states all over the country do recognize this holiday. This is not a black holiday. This is a people holiday. This day recognizes the end of enslavement of African Americans. However, so many people who were not African Americans died for that change in this country, this nation. So I just applaud you and I thank you. And if our tech person will go to my first slide, I can get this party started, okay? I have so much I want to talk to you about. There is so much rich history in Indiana. People have no idea how central Indiana was to ending slavery in this entire country. So I'm going to share some of that with you. So if we can take it to the very first slide, that's my opening page. I guess we're going to get there. The top one, just roll all the way, yeah, all the way to the top. All the way. Right there. And you can go ahead to the second page. So I am Eunice Trotter. I am director of Indiana Landmarks Black Heritage Preservation Program. And this program was created by Indiana Landmarks a couple of years ago. First, I want to tell you this a little bit about Indiana Landmarks. Indiana Landmarks is the largest private statewide preservation organization in the country. And what we do is we preserve historic sites and buildings, places. A couple years ago, Indiana Landmarks created the Black Heritage Preservation Program, realizing that so much black history and heritage has been erased. And it's been erased through various ways. Typically, when highways are constructed, they go right through the heart of black communities and wipe them out. Construction of universities and medical facilities, they erase those physical sites where black folks lived. So recognizing that, our mission in the Black Heritage Program expands beyond physical structures. It includes history that was made in these structures, but may not have evidence of those sites any longer. So our mission is to uncover, document, and preserve black heritage. If you go to the next slide. So how do we do this work? We do this work in a number of ways. The number one way is to do the research. Much black heritage has not been adequately researched, and that which has been researched often is done through the efforts of people who are not African American. So we are building capacity for doing this work by training more people how to do the research. Now, while it's done similar to any research, well, there is more effort that is required to uncover a lot of this history and heritage. We have many capital projects. These capital projects are for the purpose of preserving and restoring buildings and cemeteries, schools, homes. We do national register listings. We do historical markers. And all of this takes research. But all of it starts often with doing our genealogical training around genealogy. How do you document your own family's history? From there you go forward. So next slide, please. So I want to show you pretty quickly some of the projects that we've worked on and give you a little history about those projects. What you're looking at is the Lau Station School. The Lau Station School site on the left, you'll see, is the state that we found this site in. It's in Gibson County, Indiana. This school was part of an all-black settlement in Gibson County. It was self-sustaining. It was a farming community. There was a school, a church, a cemetery, and other sites there for that all-black community. Today it is a museum. Children in the lower third of the state visit that site all the time, and they learn about farm life for African Americans and farm life, period. There's a corn maze, and they do all kinds of things there. But it is now a very educational and wonderful site for people in that neck of the woods. Next slide, please. This is a picture of one of several one-room schoolhouses we have been able to preserve all over Indiana. These were considered the schools for African-American children. They were called colored schools. And typically they were connected to AME, which means African Baptist Episcopal churches. And this one is in Washington, Indiana. Next slide. This is a site in South Bend. It's known as the West Side Recreation Club. It is one of many recreational sites that were for African Americans because they were unable to go to other recreational sites. So we're in the process of restoring that site today. Next slide. This is a beautiful church that was built for the first Friends in Marion, Indiana, for the Quakers. And by the way, I think Mr. Brown, for whom Brown County was named, was also a Quaker. This church is now in the hands of a small black congregation. This church was designed by a architect whose name is Samuel Plato in the early 1900s. And just to give you some idea of the challenge that he faced at that time, he had to sit across from his clients because his clients, as a result of racism, did not want them sitting next to them. So he had to learn how to draw upside down in order to design these kinds of structures. So next slide, please. So I like to always talk a little bit about how did black folks get in Indiana in the first place? You know, where did it come from? Who bought us here? If you'll go to the next slide. So we're going to go through this pretty quickly, my tech partner. But African Americans were here in Indiana before the Northwest Territory was created in 1787. So the Northwest Territory includes those states you see listed on the screen, Ohio, Indiana, and so forth. These states comprise the Northwest Territory. This was a chunk of land carved out after the Revolutionary War that was considered part of the Wild West. So after that was carved out, there was settlement that began here. People began flooding into this area, and they came for land grants and to have opportunity. Next slide. Some were brought to Indiana as slaves. By the French who arrived in the late 1600s. We were able to see in St. Xavier Church records down in Knox County, Indiana, records that show marriages and births and deaths of African Americans in Indiana in the 1600s. Next slide. Some were free people. This community right here was once inhabited by Native Americans, and there we believe there were African Americans right here with them. Some lived with them, some lived on their own. At the next slide. Many came as a result of the land claims that I mentioned that were given to Revolutionary War veterans and their descendants, and they needed laborers when they arrived here. Who's going to clear this rugged land? Who's going to do the work? Next slide. Many came with Southerners who were from slave states. These Southerners came from Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, Virginia, and other slave states. Slavery for them was a way of life, and when they came, they brought their slaves with them. Next slide. So free blacks arrived in Brown County less than 4 years after the county was formed, and they probably were here before then. So when I look in the 1840 census, and I did look, last night I was up at 2 o'clock in the morning, there were 23 African Americans in Brown County who were enumerated. So that doesn't mean that there were just 23 here. That just means there were 23 who got counted. Just like today, you know, people don't always allow themselves to be enumerated, you know. Yeah, so, yeah. You know, but for, you know, to be discovered that they are here. Next slide. Okay, so in 1850, there were 18 African Americans here in Brown County who were enumerated, and I did a little research on a few of them. I found that most of them were related to just a few families, the Warwicks and the Manuals. Now, these families were mulatto, and they were from North Carolina. I found that Ephraim went to Vigo County, then he later went on to Michigan and he died. These families were property-owning families here in Brown County. Next slide. By 1860, there was only one African-American enumerated in the census in Brown County. Now, I wanted to kind of stop on this word mulatto here, and that is an actual racial designation that you'll see in the census. When you see the census forms, you'll see it as a M. Sometimes people misinterpret that as a W, but M is biracial. So, mulattoes are a biracial group of people. They're typically European and African American. Mulattoes have always existed. Typically, the maternity of mulattoes has included a black mother and a European father. However, today we see just the opposite. In the 2010 census, there were 9 million people in this country who were enumerated as biracial or mulatto. Today, that number is 33 plus million people. Now, you can't necessarily decide to determine who's black and white. I just want you to know that. Yeah. Your eyes may see. One of the jokes I make sometimes when I do presentations is, if the Klan did DNA, half the people wouldn't be eligible. Because you cannot tell books by cover. I was my old boss, Marsh Davis, who's retired president, matter of fact, in the Indiana Landmarks, and I were at an event one day, and he said to me, Eunice, she's black. Because you cannot tell, you know, by what you see, what ethnicity a person is. So I wanted to just give you some of those examples of some people who would be considered mulatto, including our presidential candidate, Kamala Harris. She would be considered mulatto back in that day. Next slide. So studies show that when young people know who they are, who their heritage is, what their ethnicity is, who their grandparents are, they perform better in school, they have fewer behavioral problems, they have a sense of who they are in the bigger scheme of things. They don't think the world revolves around them. This is not me saying this information. This is people who are experts in these arenas. When you have children who don't know who they are the ones who are going to be a problem. And oftentimes in our times that we're dealing with now, biraciality has an impact on that because they typically end up being taught one part of their heritage, their lives, who they are, when they need to have the full picture of who they are. So next slide, please. So, was Indiana a free state? We always go there because we have been taught in school that Indiana was up north and therefore it was a free state. If you'll go to the next slide. So let's look at this. Now the Mason-Dixon line you'll see on this map is that white line running right through to south of Indiana. That is the Mason-Dixon line. It was established in the 1700s. It divides what was north from what was south. What was free states from what were slave states. The blue being the free states, the gray being the slave states. Next slide. Okay, and I've mentioned to you that this area was carved out in 1787. It's part of the Northwest Territory. Now, in the Northwest Territorial Ordinance, it says in a clause that there shall be neither slavery nor indentured servitude in the old Northwest Territory. Next slide. Then even in Indiana's 1816 Constitution, because Indiana became a state in 1816, it says the same thing. Next slide. However, slavery was allowed and did persist in Indiana until the 1830s. Now, there will be people who will argue with me about this. They'll say, no way. Indiana was a free state. Now, this is an example, just one, of hundreds and hundreds of examples of slaves being enumerated in Indiana after Indiana became a state. Now, you might not be able to see this in the room. Hopefully, you might be able to see it on the Zoom. The way that arrow is, it shows you that this man, General W. Johnston, who was a very significant figure in Indiana history, phoned a slave, and it's, he's, that person is enumerated there in that information. Next slide. Now, the way that Indiana had enslavement in this state was through what is known as these indentured servitude contracts. And when we were in school, we were taught that if you're an indentured servant, you're someone whose passage from Europe or some other country has been paid for. So you get here and you work off the cost of that passage. That is how we were taught about indentured servitude. Indentures were also applied to juveniles. So if you were a kid and your parents weren't around anymore, you had to be placed in someone's custody, you became indentured to them. In Indiana, these indentured contracts were used to enslave African Americans. These contracts, and these are copies of contracts that are real contracts that we have uncovered, and they're all over the state in various boxes and rooms and drawers and finding them everywhere. These contracts were in force. They had to be signed by this person wanting to the state as a slave. They signed the contract within so many months after they arrived in Indiana. And these contracts indentured them to work for 30, 60, or 90 years. I want that to sit with you. 30, 60, or 90 years. If you refuse to sign one of these contracts, you could then be sold down the river. You heard that phrase, I'm going to sell you down the river. Well, that was literally what happened here in Indiana. People who refused to sign these contracts were sold down the river from the Ohio to the Mississippi into hard slavery. Although enslavement was not that much different in Indiana. Next slide, please. Now, what stopped this was a lawsuit that was filed. There were a couple, actually. There were many lawsuits filed in Indiana. This is one of the reasons that I say Indiana was the epicenter of the fight over slavery. We have so much rich history and significance on a national level that we are just beginning to understand. Indiana was the epicenter of whether this nation was going to be a slave country or not. So one of these lawsuits was filed by my own great-great-great-grandmother, Mary Bateman Clark. Next slide. Mary Bateman Clark was brought to Indiana by her enslaver, who was a relative to William Henry Harrison, in 1814. She came into Knox County with Harrison, who was joining his uncle. His uncle was General Washington Johnston. Now, General Washington Johnston is this huge figure in Indiana history that we don't know a lot about because he's just not celebrated today like he was in the early 1900s and late 1800s. But he's the person who brought masonry to Indiana. He was a territorial judge and legislator and clerk and property owner and slaveholder. He bought, because these indentures had value, he purchased the indenture from his nephew, Harrison, Benjamin J. Harrison, and then he owned Mary Bateman Clark. So Mary Bateman Clark went about her business in Knox County as a domestic for General Washington, and she became the object, and there's discussion over whether she did this willingly or not, of a lawsuit. She became the focus of that suit. She filed this suit in the Knox County Circuit Court, and she lost it, like a lot of people have done. And then she took her case to the Indiana State Supreme Court, and she won that lawsuit. Now, this lawsuit set a precedent in Indiana for these indentured servitude cases, because most African Americans had some type of indenture associated with their presence here in Indiana. So this case became a precedent. We should have learned about this in school, but we didn't. So this case became one of two precedent-setting cases that stopped slavery. It didn't stop it immediately, but it set a precedent so that when people took these cases to court, and there were a lot of white allies who were taking these cases to court for these black people, and soon that institution ended in Indiana. So by the 1830s, slavery had ceased to exist in Indiana. However, just as slavery was ceasing to exist in Indiana, something else started rearing its ugly head. Next slide, please. And then the next slide. I wrote a book about Mary Clark's story, so I just bought that. I wanted to show you all this. And also had a marker installed down at the Knox County Circuit Courthouse in honor of this case. And then the next slide. I won't show you this video now because I don't know if you're connected, but that's a trailer of a documentary that was produced. Well, you know what? If you will go ahead and push that button, I hope you can hear it. This is just 2 minutes long.
I'm not sure to bring
it. I don't know if we can hear it, but... Okay, if we can't hear it, then go ahead. This is an hour-long documentary that's shown on PBS, and it talks about the Mary Bateman Clark case. They usually show it during Black History Month. So it's a good documentary. It tells the story of the case that I just mentioned to you. So as I continue to talk about where African Americans came from and what happened when African Americans got to Indiana, as they came into this state, they began settling all over the state in different areas. We have a project now with Landmarks where we're trying to match the nature preserves with areas that were black settlements. These were like communities way back in the woods somewhere, away from folks, where these people built communities, schools, so forth, churches. This is just a few of them. We've been able to document it. 90 of these that existed before the Civil War throughout Indiana. Next slide, please. So there is huge evidence that Brown County itself was part of an underground railroad pathway. There's not been enough research done here. We also know that even later, after this period of enslavement and that kind of thing, that this community was a go-to spot for many African Americans, including artist John Wesley Hardrick. John Hardrick was a very famous, infamous artist who lived in Indianapolis, and he spent a lot of time here doing landscapes. His work now it's worth thousands and thousands of dollars, too, by the way. So, yeah, but Hardrick would use the scenery from Brown County to paint. The State Museum is doing this huge exhibit of his work in February in Indianapolis, if you're interested. But next slide, please. So, you won't see Brown County documented as an underground railroad site here. But it is, and again, that research that I mentioned earlier is so critical that it be done. Now, there's gold in them there hills, okay? When you are an underground railroad site, and you can document that site, your communities receive federal dollars. There's funding associated that then can be tied to tourism. So, you have to be certified. We're having a conference in Indianapolis on October the 17th, 18th, that Friday, talking about the Underground Railroad Trail. The state of Indiana, through DHPA, the Department of Historic Preservation and Architecture, is responsible for the Underground Railroad Trail system in Indiana. But it's been kind of just put on the shelf and let go because there wasn't enough work and research going on. But for Brown County, this is an FYI, everybody. Think about that because there are federal dollars that will help you improve and research and recognize our Underground Railroad history. So, next slide. So, here's the warning. Warning, history, and particularly black history, can be uncomfortable. It's not necessarily nice all the time. What you're looking at now is a picture of a lynching that occurred in Marion, Indiana in the 1930s. In this case, these two men were lynched in front of this huge crowd that included children. It was a heinous act, so I won't dwell on this, but Indiana did have these kinds of colored-only or white-only signs in businesses, etc. So next slide, please. I wanted to let you know that in the 1830s, these laws concerning black folks in Indiana began to change. This is when the Indiana Colonization Society was created. What is that? The Colonization Society's plan was to ship all the black folks back to Africa. And they raised money, and they received state funding and private funding to help get black folks out of here, because the belief was it was better to get them out of here than to even deal with all of the consequences of having black folks in Indiana. These black codes that came out during this particular time required African Americans who came into Indiana to pay a $500 bond, or they couldn't come in. This went on in many areas around the state, and it had a chilling effect on the population. In other words, a lot of black folks started getting out of Indiana. They just didn't have the money. They moved to Ohio, Illinois, Canada, wherever. Got to get out of Indiana. This continued on into the 1840s and 50s when the Indiana Constitution changed. In that Constitution, which was a new Constitution for the state, there was Article 13. Article 13 says you can't come into the state at all if you're black. Also, if you're already in the state, you must go to your county clerk's office and register your presence and prove it by taking a witness, typically a white person, with you to prove that you were in this state before that constitution was enacted. And of course, that also had a chilling effect. Yeah. So more black folks got the heck out of Indiana again. And, you know, they were discouraged from coming. And you can see when that article was rescinded. It took a while, but it was rescinded. Next slide. Okay. Into Brown County. After the 1850s, Brown County and neighboring counties saw significant black population declines. And you'll see the numbers there on the screen. Brown counties fell, you see, as well. Next slide. So, why did that happen? Well, it is historians' belief that a lot of it had to do with how the culture was going for black folks at that time. There are a lot of things that were being created, and one of them was the National Horse Thief Detective Association. Now, you might not have heard of that, but this was an organization that was created, started in central Indiana, became a national organization, and the purpose of it was to stop horse thievery. Because back in that day, if somebody's horse was stolen, they were in trouble. Transportation, labor on the farm, all kinds of things. So, you know, most communities only had a sheriff, and that sheriff didn't have the bandwidth to get out and stop all of this thievery that was going on. So this association was formed, and Brown County had a chapter. If you'll go to the next slide. I wanted to show you that Brown County hosted the 57th conference of this association back in 1917. You'll see some of the people who were officers of it. Now, what makes this organization even more interesting in terms of race relations is its reach expanded beyond horse thieves. This was one of the forerunner groups to groups like the White Caps and the KKK. And this is an uncomfortable history that I want to talk about with you as well. All of this isn't pretty. Now, this organization, yes, had a wonderful charge and did good work, but it also acted as a group that would discourage the diversification of Brown County's population. Next slide. I found this clip. I thought it was kind of interesting. It talks about how the Klan came to Brown County in 1923, and the crowd was the largest crowd that had ever been seen in Nashville. Now, again, this is uncomfortable history for some. But it is, like that's what my kids say, it is what it is. It is what it is. Next slide. Okay, if you go to the next slide. So, all of this back to Juneteenth, which is one of the major reasons that I'm here to share with you. So what is this whole thing about Juneteenth and why should it be celebrated? Juneteenth celebrates not only the emancipation of African Americans, but of this nation. Thousands of white people were killed over this issue of slavery. Thousands and thousands. Brother killing brother. Cousin killing cousin. This is a celebration not just for African Americans, but for our entire nation. Next slide. So this day, as you see, was celebrated actually way before Juneteenth became law in 2021. This day was celebrated in Indiana by black and white people back in the 1860s in September. Someone mentioned earlier September 20th. You have it?
Yes, 22nd.
September 22nd. That was called Emancipation Day in Indiana. And what would happen is there would be a big, you know, wang-dang-doodle at the state fairgrounds, and everybody would come in, there'd be hog roasts and dancing, and it would be a celebration. It was for all people. It was predominantly black in some communities. In some communities, there were diverse groups. You know, people will come for different reasons. Some will come for the food, some will come for the music, but it was a celebration. Next slide. Our holiday celebrates the last people to be released from enslavement. Now, you know that when the Emancipation Proclamation was announced in 1863, everybody didn't get released at once. It wasn't like, hey, you know, Lincoln emancipates everybody leaves and goes on off their merry way. There were no cell phones and TVs and none of that kind of communication, although there was a pipeline of information. However, a lot of African Americans who were enslaved on these plantations were not able to leave these plantations because the overseers of those plantations would not allow that to happen. And that's because who's going to pick the crops? Who's going to harvest those fields? Who's going to do that work? No, you can't leave. You can't leave. And many did not. And that happened in waves across the country into the later 1860s when Galveston, Texas became the last site to allow these enslaved people to leave. And they were allowed at gunpoint. A troop from Indiana, it was an all-black troop, it was called the United States Colored Troops, the 28th. And that group of men, some of them likely from right here in this community, were in the Civil War for the Union, and they went to Galveston, and they were the ones who enforced the proclamation. And those people then were freed. Many of them came back. The United States Colored Troops came back to Indiana. we have found evidence that they were instrumental in settling a south side part of Indianapolis, Norwood, and we know that they came back all over Indiana to live their lives out. And so that is the significance of Juneteenth. It was June 19th when these people were released. However, people were released throughout various periods. It's that date, however, that became a federal holiday in 2021. And this map that you're looking at, you'll see the states that recognize Juneteenth and those that don't. While it's a federal holiday, for it to be a state holiday, it has to be approved on a state level by the legislature, on a county level by the commissioners, as your wonderful commissioners have done today, making, I believe, you the very first county in Indiana to do this. And I don't know if we have reporters here or not, but that word, oh, okay, that word really should get out, because this is really something significant, that what we've done today. So next slide, please. So, you know, how do you observe it? What do you say? What does it mean? Well, it's observed like the 4th of July. It's a celebration. You can do it with art, you can do it with dance, you can do it with fashion. I mean, it is a party. It is time for a community to come together and have a great time, to reflect, to have speakers. I mean, you can do a variety of things. When I came to work at Indiana Landmarks, my boss, Marsh Davis, had made Juneteenth a holiday for Indiana Landmarks employees. Many Indiana companies do give their employees that day off as a holiday. But they're private entities, not government bodies like this commission. And so my boss said, you know, well, what we do for Juneteenth is make it a day of service. So I told Marge, look, you can make it a day of service, but I'm going to make it a day of celebration. So we started doing concerts. So the last 2 years that I've been there, we've had these big concerts, and, you know, they've been great, diverse audience. This year we made $10,000. So there are ways to make money. Like I said, there's gold in them there. So we made money for our program doing this concert. We had a great time. We introduced people to music and to artists they hadn't been introduced to before. This year, for 2025, I'm trying to decide what we're going to do, you know, how we're going to celebrate. So it's been a great time. And so, you know, what do you say? Someone say, well, what do you say for Juneteenth? That's the same thing you say for Happy 4th of July. Happy Juneteenth. So, you know, it is a holiday. It is a time that this nation should celebrate what we have gone through to get to where we are today. And there's been a lot of bloodshed for us to get to today. So it's very significant. Next slide, please. So, you know, I always say Black history is part of the full story of our history. It is not history that sits on the counter over here, while this is Asian history and this is French. It is part of our full story. It is filtered into every fiber of American history and life. And it is so important that we recognize that. Next slide, please. So, this is going to conclude my presentation, and I want to thank you for all that you have done here to get to this day. I appreciate you all, and I look forward to coming back and saying hi and visiting this beautiful landscape in the very near future. Because as I drove here, I saw cabins, and I
issues that are part of our history. Some of it's very ugly,
You know, this country almost split 75 years after it was established over this issue. And we can't forget that. You know, it's one thing, you go tear down a statue of some Confederate general if you want to, but it doesn't change history. You know, what happened, happened. And I appreciate the fact that you're interested in preserving history, all of it, whether it was good or bad. I thank you very much for that. We have an hour's worth of business to do.
There's somebody else that wants to say something over here.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, up to the microphone.
My father moved to Brown County in 1939, and he was warden of the CCC camp, which many people, most everybody's heard of. But the blacks, the CCC camp was out in, it's still, it was just for yellow ladies. That he was the foreman of a black CCC camp, which just happened in early 30s. And it
what was they for?
My father, I don't know what you call it, but he's he had a black he was foreman. And he graduated from DePaul University and just finished his degree. And they gave him a job running the CCC camp. And he said he had never seen a black person before. And it was an education for him. And he said that the camp had book club. They had cards and all kinds of activities for workers. And the workers ran bulldozers and dug out the lake. And which I thought was interesting. And
he went on to support black rights.
There you go.
And my father later went and was on the board of the black
NAACP.
He went. He was very active in the Civil Rights.
Yeah.
And he was he became a newscaster named Alan Jeffries. I've always been proud of him.
Yes.
For doing all the things that he did do.
Yes.
And he hired Barbara Boyd.
Oh, really?
The first black woman in radio.
Yes.
And she was now. Yes.
CCC, I believe it was the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Right.
They built the state park as part of the FDR's program to put people back to work. And they did a lot of construction and different things for the community.
You have time for one more?
One more.
Yes, I'm Madison Miller, a local Republican voter. I just want to say how much I I deeply appreciate your willingness to revisit this issue and to right a wrong that may have been made. What I don't appreciate is the 25 minutes that Commissioner Wolper was absent from this room that was supposed to be an educational opportunity. Vocally in opposition to county employees celebrating Juneteenth. That's all.
Thank you very much.
You rock.
Okay, we have some business to do.
We've got quite a bit.
Yeah, we need to get moving.
Thank everybody that come for this issue.
Yeah, thank you all. We have a 2-hour time in our meetings, and then we have about 15-some minutes left, so we'll try to get through this again. Next on our agenda is Ross Benson. If you'd come to the microphone, please, and tell us what you know about the RDC.
Gee, Ross, it looks like you're running them out.
Start to follow up.
Is this on or off?
On.
Here. Hello, everybody. My name is Ross Benson. I've been president of the RDC here in County for this year. This incarnation of the RDC first met in February, and then had our first full meeting in March. We've since been meeting on a regular basis, third Tuesday every month, right here in this room. Brown County's had an RDC for roughly 10 years. When we came in to start this year, we really didn't have like a handoff book or anything indicating what the RDC is supposed to be doing here in Brown County or in Indiana even. And I've looked and I've tried to find recordings or minutes from meetings when the commissioners and or the council first created the RDC, which I believe was around 2014, so right around 10 years ago. And I haven't been able to find any history on that either. What was the reason? Why did they want to create the RDC? But they did. And the commissioners and the council has been appointing a six-member board, but a five-member voting board for the past 10 years to begin or do business related to RDC permitted and authorized activity in Brown County. I've prepared a little handout for you guys up at the desk, so you have it. I'm going to try to be real brief on this. The first page basically covers what the Indiana statute requires or stipulates. What is Brown County? What does RDC work? And what the RDC typically does is infrastructure and help in aiding and financing and or putting in infrastructure that might not otherwise happen if there wasn't an RDC in place. They're also tasked to look for deterioration, for blight, for distressed properties in the county that are distressed for a reason. Either they don't have plumbing, they don't have water, they don't have electricity, broadband's a big infrastructure thing now in Indiana. And then we're tasked to participate and join in other local boards and or groups in the county to help and do what we can do. So one of the things that RDCs can do is create land banks, buy properties, try to resell them, try to improve them and resell them. There's a lot of things that RDC could do that is probably above the budget of Brown County to go and infuse thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars in purchasing property for land bank use. But there are things that the RDC can do in Brown County. And one of the first things that they can do, and they have already done in Brown County, is to create and or expand economic development areas. Helmsburg was identified, I think, back in 2017. And the RDC got involved with them, and one of the things that the RDC did at that point was create an economic development area, which essentially encompasses Helmsburg proper, you know, and it has given Helmsburg kind of a boost up in terms of, they've also created a CDC, which is a community development corporation. As you guys know, there's only one municipality in Brown County which has a voice, which is the town of Nashville. All of the other little municipalities around the county really don't have that kind of structure. And they don't have a go-to person or function within the county to say, hey, where can we get this help? Short of coming here and seeing you guys. But the so we're looking, as we're tasked to look around the county, look at areas. And there are many areas that the RDC could and should be looking at over the period of time, including Knobbone, Cordy, Sweetwater, Bean Blossom, Jackson Township, Fruitdale, Spearsville, even Story down south. There's plenty of areas when you get out and look around that, you know, perhaps an RDC can be helpful in these local communities. This year, for a couple of reasons, we've pretty much focused on the existing economic development area in Helmsburg, with the knowledge that there's a lot of activity going out there in sewer. Sewer very well will be coming out of Helmsburg, heading east on 45, over into the Bean Blossom area. That is a potential spur to additional economic activity. People could start to invest now that they've got plumbing in their business. I know Brownie's up there. Trailer Park, those guys are just screaming for, you know, plumbing, septic to come in there, which would make their lives, you know, so much easier. We've also been looking at the Opry Zone area here south of town, because we know there's a lot of activity going on here, which you guys are all well aware of. We feel, you know, we're looking at the Indiana statute in that our activities should benefit the public health and safety, should increase the economic well-being of the unit and the state. We want to drive up property value. We should serve to protect and increase property values in the unit and the state. One of the things we're focused on primarily here is creation or expansion of economic development areas. And I've handed out some maps to you guys so you can see what we're talking about there. The one up north looks like this one. Starts out in Helmsburg. You can see the Helmsburg area, which is pretty much outlined, I believe, in pink here. But then you can see all this additional area coming back and heading towards Bean Blossom. And then there's another area, another map here, which kind of depicts the area south and to the west of Nashville, including the Opry property, coming up as far north and just south of Annandale States. One of the things we've also been just started doing is working and meeting with APC. We hope to be part of their work in the development of the new comprehensive plan. We feel, and I believe the people at APC feel, that it would be helpful in that when we do the work and look at areas for this economic development area, we'll be creating micro analysis of the specific area. Now, when the comprehensive plan people coming in, they're going to be looking for information like this, and they want to string that all into the entire Brown County comprehensive plan. So we're hopeful that with the stuff that we do in the RDC can help the APC in their work as well. And so the two will kind of be working hand in hand. Another thing that RDCs are able to do, but I think we don't have any requests for this type of activity, but it is called TIF financing. TIF financing is in the case of a property where somebody came in and they want to do some work. There isn't, let's say, sewer and water as a good example there already. Banks are very hesitant to loan money to developers on infrastructure because if anything happens, they can't go back in and seize that infrastructure work. So they're reluctant to do that. That's another reason that RDCs have been given some powers to do that work, to try to be able to create financing that would allow that type of infrastructure to be put in place, then allowing additional development. But as I've said, the RDC currently has no request for any of that activity in front of us. I think you guys would know if it would, because it would probably come through you guys in the first place. But there is a way to use that tool, in which you would dedicate an area as an allocation area. An allocation area would be an area that you anticipate AV investment is going to be happening. And so, for an example, you have this corridor up in Jackson Township that runs from Bean Blossom all the way back over to Helmsburg. There are certain areas in that piece of land, a piece of Brown County, that will begin to see beginnings of investment once the sewer comes in. The apartment building here, new store here, gas station. As these projects come on, they will increase the AV, the appraised value of the properties in that area. What a RDC, and I am working with some various attorneys here in the state to get clarification on this concept, is the RDC can create an allocation area, for example, in these maps. Well, here's an economic development area. But then create smaller zones, allocation zones, within the economic development area, which would then basically draw that increased tax revenue as that appraised value increases. What that does is has those increased appraised value receipts, as they come into the county, they can be put into the RDC, which then is by law required to invest that money back into the area from which it came. So that is a concept of kind of usually called revenue retention, in that if the I-45 corridor begins to see growth, begins to see increase in appreciated values, that increased tax revenue coming into the county, this is a program that would allow the county, through the RDC, to just set that money aside and put it in accounts that are dedicated to be spent back into those economic development areas, to continue improving them, 5, 10, 15, 20 year plan kind of thing. So that's it in a nutshell. I don't want to take up much more of your time, but there's information here in this 5-page. You guys know how to get a hold of it if you want. What I would be curious and eager to find out, since we don't have the Brown County Commissioner's proclamation or statement of when they created and why they created an RDC, if this kind of work would fit in with your vision for the county.
Let me ask you this, Ross. So I feel like you're one of the strongest boards, really, that we've got of appointees in the county, maybe an exception or two, but you guys are very, very strong, and you've got a little bit of money. Now, could you do what you need to do without that money? Because I know the county council has tried to loot the health department and that.
Yeah, we have no budget. So, I mean, I've heard talk about money being in the fund, and that is not, at this point that I understand, whether it's completely free to use or not. So I'm meeting with you guys today. I'm meeting tomorrow with the county council, and I'm trying to just get an idea on where this might go. I mean,
yeah, I look at it like, a surgeon can be perfect, but if you don't give him some tools to work with, you can't get much done, right?
We're going to need some kind of a budget to do if we want to proceed. Because everything's got to be done correctly, legally, done all the I's, crossed the T's. And we, as part of the work that we do, want to be able to do a sort of a thorough evaluation on these micro areas, little studies, because we want to be able to hand off some good information back to the planning, area planning committee, for them to use in their plans. And then finally, one of our goals this year is to create this handoff book to give to whatever the next, you know, board at the RDC is going to look like. There's always people turning over year after year. Like I say, we walked in this year, we had five people who had never met. A couple of them had served on previous boards, but it took us a while to kind of get our bearing. What we're looking for is activity that can keep the RDC active and involved in Brown County, because right now we just basically have these boards that sit around and meet up and have no money, no authority, well, we can't really do much of anything.
Appreciate that.
And so we're just looking for some kind of feedback from you guys if this is what you envision.
I stand corrected, but I believe that what's left of the SOC factory money is under your purview. It's not been allocated. It would have to be allocated by the county council. But I think there's, what is there, about
$228,000
sitting there, which was actually the result of the sale of a donation by the former SOC factory owner that was intended to be used basically for Helmsburg, and to be recognized in honor of her son, her late son. We did use, I think, $175,000 of it as a match for the stormwater project that got completed a couple of years ago. So, yes, meet with the county council and maybe you can work something out here. But I'd like to see this go forward. I actually was a bit of a part of the creation of the RDC. I was on the council at that time. And the late Evan Worley, he's a very intelligent man, looked at things, and we had an EDC at the time, the Economic Development Corporation, but it had no power to do anything. And so he said, we need to have a redevelopment commission, which now you have a lot of power. Those five people on that board have a lot of power. You can do a lot of things that could be done otherwise.
Yeah, I think it's a unique opportunity for Brown County. Everything I see the RDC doing would be in conjunction with the commissioners, the council, the APC, so, you know, the planning and zoning. It's not like the RDC is going to go out and say, hey, this is what we're doing, you know. It should be more kind of a reverse process in that, you know, people within the county are going to see things coming up and say, hey, this is something that would be a good handoff for the RDC to start working on as well. So we, you know, look forward, you know, opportunities like that to come up as well.
Thank you, Ross. We really appreciate what you've done and your presentation. Go ahead. Yeah.
This is my two cents worth. I kind of remember the SOC factory situation where, and I've actually talked a little bit with our attorney. I'd like to look at that a little harder, because my understanding was that the lady donated the property to the county, okay, with the wishes that there would be a park named in her son's name.
A park?
A park.
Okay.
Named in her son's name. The transfer of that was from them to the county, so there has to be a record of that property, because the county could have never sold it if there wasn't, because you got to give the people buying a clear title. So we need to go look and see, and it's kind of my understanding somewhat what Jerry has said is the county council controls the purse strings, but we need to identify the purpose of that and not get too far away from it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, again, a lot of what I was looking for, you know, when the RDC was created, we had got ADC, the Economic Development Council, went to the RDC. Where's the records of that? You know, what was the thoughts? What was the intent?
You need to go back sometime between 2010 and 2014,
yeah,
and look at the minutes, okay, and see what we can find.
That's hard.
It's there. Yeah. No, it's there. We just, it's a lot of work, but we need to look at it and not make a knee-jerk,
yeah, that's,
reaction.
I mean, that's kind of out of, I hear what you're saying, and that particular aspect of it, you know, it's got to be resolved. But for what the RDC is doing, I'm saying, it's like, I don't know where it's coming from, but in order for us to do this type of work, we need some kind of budget to run with for it.
I think I seen a hand from somebody that might know something.
Mark.
Can you come to the microphone, sir?
He's coming up. I might say that, as I recall, the county could not receive that donation or the sale of it, and so that's why it went to the RDC. And the RDC is actually, if I recall right, is the entity that actually sold it. And to the Beamery, I think people sit there and bought it. Is that correct? Yeah, because there was something in the law that we couldn't just take that as a donation, so it went through the RDC. Yeah, but the money's still sitting.
I understand the controversy on that funding, and I'm kind of staying away from that part of it.
It's got to go
for good reason, but
yeah, okay. Mark, what do you know?
Oh, I was just going to clarify. I know, and unfortunately, I didn't know this was going to be a topic until just a few hours ago. But I know, I think it was 2011, I want to say, is when Sharon Rosenbach donated the sock factory after the fire to the county. So what the stipulations that were given was she wanted to see, as Jerry mentioned, she was hoping to see this sock factory converted into some form of recreational facility for the county. We did several studies, feasibility studies, essentially on what do we do with that, because of the way it was initially engineered and constructed, it was going to be too difficult to do any kind of remodeling. Actually, it was just going to be cost prohibitive to remodel it, to put in any form like a gymnasium. We would have had to bring in specially engineered beams that essentially, like I said, it's going to cost more than what the building was probably going to do. So I think at that point, I want to say it was 2012, I'm quoting on that, but I think that's when it was determined that at this point, the county would be better off looking at selling the facility. And what was pledged to Mrs. Rubenbart was that the money that was gained from that, the sale of the stock factory, would then be used to construct some type of a recreational facility that bears the name of the Timothy Magnuson Recreation Facility. So that, I don't know what the stipulations were at that time as far as.
Do you have any documentation?
I probably got a file about 2 feet thick, so I'll have to dig. But
there's nothing stating on deeds or anything else about any of that.
Okay. So yeah, I just wanted to add that clarification in there on that. So I'll look and see what I can come up with. But again, it may take me a little bit of time.
Thank you. You'll be the only
one that asks? Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah.
My memory is not what it once was, and that's been 10 years ago, so it's like,
you know what? Any other questions for me?
I don't think so, but thank you for your report. Appreciate it. Okay, next on the agenda, the Brown County Lighting Ordinance. Blake, a few tells.
Mike, are you there? Smoke on the phone?
Yeah.
Here.
Hey, Mike, so if you could bring us up to date on the APC, their reading of it was the first reading. This could be a second, except we didn't get 48 hours. If you could just go through the mechanics of that and let us know where we're at on this.
Yeah, so the zoning amendment proposal was submitted to the APC by the commissioners. The ABC has reviewed it and given a negative recommendation for it. That recommendation is then forwarded to the commissioners, to which the commissioners can now decide whether or not to approve their recommendation, overturn it, or amend the recommendation. We're going to introduce their recommendation today, and then at the next meeting on October 16th, we will give additional notice of this 48 hours before the commissioners can vote on that recommendation.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know, so everybody can study
up on it.
Yeah, Blake,
you can give just a general overview of what the proposed amendment is intended to do. That would be good for today's meeting, and then the rest of the discussion can be held on October 16th, should you choose to do that.
Okay, well, just basically what we're doing here on the ordinance is, without going through all of it, we're concentrating on the interior lit part, and as it's said in here, it's on, it can be gleaned online or else picked up at the office, or we can ask Kayla to go through that chapter and verse.
I have the actual ordinance here.
You're so efficient.
So this would be, oh, for the record, Kayla Robertson, planning director. This was section 4.15 under basic prohibitions. The wording was remained the same there. The proposed changes begin under section 5, performance standards. Letter A, the change there would be that the source of light may not point toward any oncoming traffic unless it is internally illuminated in 9,000 lumens or less. Signs that are externally illuminated may not point toward any oncoming traffic. Commercial property located on or near a state road in Brown County, Indiana may display a qualifying illuminated sign to promote a business. A source of light may be used to illuminate a sign to promote a business within the county if the illumination level does not exceed the manufacturer's original maximum lumens specification for the sign. In no circumstance may a sign exceed 9,000 lumens. And the last change for that, again, we're at section 4.15. For an electronic sign that flashes multiple illuminated messages, each message must stay continuous for at least 10 seconds before changing to a subsequent message.
And that's basically all the changes?
That was all the proposed changes.
Okay. And Mike, is that going to be good enough so that now we can act on this on the 16th?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
We all set.
Yeah. You take table. You want to make a motion to table?
I make a motion to deny.
Oh.
This is when. Well, I'll make that motion next time.
You can get a chance to do it next.
Oh, time. I think I make that motion. This is going to be another one of your ordeals, is it, Blake?
I'm just one out of three.
So, definitely, we're just,
do we need to make a motion to move it, Mike, or is it just automatically going to be moved to the 16th?
No motion can be made at this point. You can only table it, which you do not need to make a motion to do so, for the 16th. On the 16th, that's when a motion can be made.
Okay, we don't have to do anything right now.
No.
Thank you.
Okay, so we don't need to vote on tape. Okay.
No.
Boy, I got that in there, didn't I?
Well, I think we know where you stand.
Yeah.
Well,
we kind of already knew that.
Yeah. Okay, Kayla, you're up next again. The plan consultant service contract.
Okay, so is this working?
Yeah, it's working.
It was.
It is. It didn't seem like it was, but it is.
Okay.
I can hear.
So the Plan Commission decided last night to enter into a service agreement with Veritas Group, LLC, for the development of a comprehensive plan. The decision was made last night with a 5-0 vote with two committee members absent. I have forwarded that contract to you guys, and basically just want your blessing on that. This is money that we have in our budget for a plan consultant. $26,750 of this $37,000 for the contract was given to the county in order to use for a new comprehensive plan.
And can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Don't you think 90 days is a little short to come up with a comprehensive plan?
Yeah. The money needs to be spent before.
Correct, but I remember a gentleman from the Brown County Community Foundation would speak. I believe he said the comprehensive plan didn't have to be finished. It just had to be worked on, and the money needed to be spent.
Correct.
And I think
that's correct.
And I think that
there was some concerns about the wording that the planning office had come up with, and did they want a professional to look at the wording to make sure it was correct? Is that, you remember that by any chance? No?
Wording of,
okay.
Wording of what?
The wording of the words that you use in the ordinance, there seemed to be a question from what I remember, that he's shaking his head no.
I don't, no one asked me a question, and I don't even know what I'm talking about. Not what you're babbling about.
That's fine. The part about spending the money, does the comprehensive plan, this is a big deal, all right? So we really need to probably look at it. Is there any plan, I mean, is there any way we can start work on it, spend the money up to that point, and then wait until 2025 to actually finish it so we can get as much input to what the residents and people of the county really want?
That is absolutely what we're working on currently. That's what is happening.
But not by the end of the year to come up with a complete plan.
That would be very, very difficult.
No.
That's what I was getting to.
Basically, what we're doing, we have a very limited budget. We have $37,000 basically to spend. That is nowhere near half of what a comprehensive plan should cost.
Well, I'm glad you set me straight.
So this is basically going to be a building block.
Okay.
So like you're playing Legos, you want to get your foundation, you're building a house, get your foundation, we're going to put up the walls after that. This is going to be an ongoing thing that needs to be looked at least once a year. And then that will help us with, there are certain grants too. You must have an updated comprehensive plan in order to apply for certain grants for countywide.
Ron, I'm glad you mentioned public input, because that is absolutely central to this. And as a result, it will take time. That's why there's no expectation to completely finish this by the end of the year. We just need to spend those funds or lose them.
That sounds good.
Yeah, we can finish it by the end of the year if you want a one-page comprehensive.
Yeah, right.
We have a non-comprehensive plan already. let's get something going here.
So I believe that if we do that, then we spend that money, and next year you're working on a grant to get the probably $60,000.
We are not eligible as a county right now. I've worked with ARA Whitney. I cannot remember her last name. But I've worked with her. Our low to moderate income numbers do not fit in countywide with what we need for an OCRA grant. So we're not eligible for a $60,000 planning OCRA grant as of right this minute. We'll have to do a study, an income study, basically. Oh, wonderful.
And a meeting, three meetings ago, I think.
Okay, so we need to act on this?
I would love it if you did. Then we can get started on...
Yeah. Well, it's a contract, so I guess that's up to us to approve.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do we have anything to actually sign here?
No.
No?
Okay. I was authorized by the APC to sign it. This is a courtesy. It just needs to be on record that you guys have reviewed the service contract and are okay with that. And I did put in this email too. I know you guys already know this. I did speak with Gary Hewitt. He's county council president. I do not need to go before the county council to request these funds because they are our funds. So just in case anybody had a question about that.
Yeah, it's already in your budget.
It's already in our budget. Yeah, we're not exceeding what we have.
So if it's needed, then I would make a motion that we would allow them to move forward.
Yeah. Yeah, motion. Here, a second. I'll second that motion. Move forward with this comprehensive plan. Use the 37 we've already got in there.
Okay.
Get started. This is way overdue. Operating with, like you said, a non-comprehensive plan for several years.
It needs to be updated with the times.
Oh, yeah.
you know, we need to know who we are, where we want to go.
It's not a one-shot deal. It's
Yeah.
On and things change. So, okay. Any discussion? Vote on it. All in favor, raise your right hand, say aye. Aye.
Just abstain.
Abstain.
Okay, yeah.
All right, then. Teresa, you're up next.
I do not have anything.
Okay.
Wait a minute. We talked earlier about the building for the veterans, so let's talk about that since you're the one that knows what's going on. I think it was a little over $4,000, and if we agree today to take at least two commissioners to write the check for $4, it's $4,000 plus. But if we get it, the secret to the rebates, 11% rebates, is you have to get them signed and mailed in. If that rebate sits on your desk, it expires, and you don't get that rebate. So basically, we're getting 11% back if we move forward. I think we've all decided that's what we want to do for the veterans. Sorry about that.
Where are you? Where are you? Perfect.
No, we're not.
So
they just came out yesterday and said that that was the building they wanted. It would work.
The other question was, is how's it going to get here? Is Menards going to deliver it?
Yeah, they deliver it in a box.
Okay, so that's took care of. So two commissioners before the next day or so, we need to sign.
Well, we have credit there, so we're just kind of calling over it.
Well, then the rebate has to be filled out and sent in.
Yes.
Like immediately.
Yes.
The $500 or so to go away.
Yeah.
So that'll drop it down to about $3,500, and then you talk to the vets about building it. You know, at some point, if they need a little help, maybe we send the maintenance guys out there and help them look at it.
I think they're going to need help.
And get some volunteers and get it up, and get it under the roof so it's not sitting out there rotten. So I just wanted to mention that while we had it. Get it taken care of. While we're also talking about the buildings, we had gotten an estimate on the CAP office. Metal roof was somewhere around $10,000. My math tells me that's like $454 and change per square. So then they come back with a shingle roof at $9,000, and that's like $409,000 and some change. If you're just looking at that, I mean, yeah, metal's probably, it's getting late in the year, it'd be better to move, but I'd like to get at least another estimate.
Well, there was somebody that called about an estimate earlier in the year. They were going to touch back with them, and Todd said that he would reach out to somebody else also.
Yeah, let's get a second estimate, third estimate on shingles. We don't have a lot of time. We're running out of weather.
We do have the funds to do that, too. It is in the line. I haven't checked that today.
Okay.
So there's...
And one more thing. The $39,000 that the EMA asked for to get a system, yesterday morning at the EMA meeting, it was my understanding that one of the council members had told them that that money is there and available. I'm not sure which fund it's in. I'll talk to you in a little bit because I'm getting a frown from the auditor. We need to identify the money, okay?
Yeah.
And then we got a couple of weeks before the next commissioner meeting, and yeah, we just need to get our master.
We could go to council and ask for an appropriation for it, and then.
Well, one of the council members seems to think the money was there. We need to identify where they're talking about, where it's at,
okay.
And that the auditor, this money's not been promised for something else, and we're not going to run any fund in the red. I like how she's shaking her head, so that's all I got on that right now. It's just we need to keep an eye on the funds coming close to the end of the year.
Yeah. You're talking about the sirens?
No, well, this is a system that supposedly connects them.
Yeah. It's like the first step.
You know, originally I think that's over $500,000 to try and put these tornado sirens in, and, you know, if we can get some grants or something. But this was the first part they really would like to get. To get started on that, after you just seen the hurricane come through down south, I was in my house on Friday night, and the trees were the smaller trees were looking like it was moving about 25, 30 feet each way. The big trees weren't moving, but there's leaves, green leaves, blowed all over the place. Limbs down everywhere. I'm sure Eric's been out dealing with it.
Knocked some of my corn down.
Yeah, so we need to make at least a step that way.
Yeah, to cover the whole county, it probably would be a half a million or whatever.
And it's complicated.
But you gotta start somewhere. You know? I mean, we used to have one cider down here. Now we've got, what, three? And maybe more.
They're trying to move forward. Like Mr. Whopper always says, we want to keep the ball moving forward.
There we go. Yep. Okay. Anything else with Teresa?
No, I didn't mean to put her on the spot, but I did want to get that out.
No, we're going to get done about this.
Good.
And now we have Mr. Eric. I don't have a lot really to talk about. We have obviously been cleaning up storm damage. Most of this week's been cleaning up storm damage. I think we're about caught up. We had a lot of call-outs last weekend. A lot of money spent over time, but it is what it is. We did what we could do for the community. So let's see here. Something else I've got an issue with, I guess, is the highways. We're not really compliant with our bridge signs. That's came to my attention through our consultants. So they gave us a list. They gave us a list a month or so ago. We've been putting the correct signs up. That being said, I'm getting ready to do an order of over 150 signs or so. We're going to blow through our sign budget, but this has to be done. It's a must. It should have been done a long time ago. So we can get in trouble for not having these done.
I think just get taken down.
No, these are advanced warning signs for posted bridges. These are signs that have never been put up.
Oh, this is something new.
Yes, correct. It's something that's been out for a while. It's just something we haven't done. It came to my attention a couple months ago. I'm actually meeting with our current inspection guy tomorrow. We'll talk about everything. I'm not sure yet. I don't have a close that. So, and then moving forward to our next four-year bridge contract, you guys have that. I've got two copies up there. I need to get that submitted to NDOT this week. I had Mike Mogul look at it. Legally, it looks great. This is all boilerplate standard stuff from NDOT. I've negotiated a few things with our new firm as far as different reports, some better reporting, some other things. When they get done with their phases. This is, federal 80-20, match. And this contract is a four-year deal, so you're looking, pay a little bit each year. It's not all one shot. So, but I do need to get that, if you guys are good, I need to get that signed and submitted. NDOT's been on me. We got to get that turned in so we make sure we get our money.
When do we have time? How much time?
It needs to be
this week.
It needs to be this week. Okay. I mean, that way, if there's any, if NDOT comes back and says, well, there's, I submitted it to them first for review. They submitted it back, said everything looks fine. Finish your negotiations and resubmit it after signatures. I just need to make sure everything goes through smooth and we can move on.
I make a motion on the contingent that I understand this a little bit better. And the other two commissioners can go ahead and sign it. If you give me it till Friday, contingent, that I do understand this before I sign it, because I was reading into it, that I understand all this. And out of those 30-some pages, there's some wording in there that I wasn't 100% on. I'm sure Mr. Allen would help me go over this and understand it. But I'll make a motion that we put a contract contingent that I have a couple days to look it over. And if for some reason I'm not happy with it, the other two commissioners can sign it and move forward. Does that make any sense?
It's really up to you guys. I mean,
does that work for you?
I would love to get it turned in this week. I understand your spot.
I said by this week.
Well, I mean, I'm not here Fridays.
Okay, then I'll take a hard look at it. Are you available tomorrow anytime?
Okay. I'll take a hard look at it tomorrow.
All right.
I'll get probably one of the smart guys in the room.
I appreciate it. Yeah, because I've been in contact with Jesse Avant, which is the coordinator for NDOT, and I talked to him yesterday and told him this should be submitted this week. I already did my quarterly report for this that we have to do, and I got it submitted, and it's approved. I just need to stay on top of this.
That's fine.
I don't lose any money.
But a motion.
That's a little bit confusing, though, and I'm just going to try and clarify. Okay. So you're saying you're making a motion to approve it once you look at it?
Yes.
I'm just asking, is that what you're saying?
I need to understand some of the verbiage. I don't have a PhD in literature.
Okay.
Mr. Allen has agreed to help me go over it to make sure. When I run for the office.
Have you looked at this?
Me? Yes. I've went over it. Like I said, I've had NDOT go over it. I mean, each firm has different fees, but they're all within NDOT's specs, you know.
But you're good with this.
I'm good with it. Speaking back with, I spoke with the people at Aegis, going back and forth. I'm okay with it. Granted, this is the first one I've done. I'm green at this. But it's not out of the ordinary as far as NDOT. NDOT's not telling me, well, wait a second, you better check this out, you better check that out. Everything looks good. And going off of what I've negotiated kind of with the reports at the end, I think we're getting pretty good stuff as far as, you know, reports from our bridges. I'm happy with it, but I mean, it's, you guys have to sign
so,
it.
So if that's the case, then if this, if you would happen to die.
Is that correct?
I'm not. Okay. So let's just take this in order. He made a motion.
Yeah. Okay. If I don't get a second, you can make none. Which you probably don't do. And you're going to sign today. You won't give me 24 hours of review.
That's fine.
Whatever you guys want to do. I presented, I mean, then my job presented to you guys. It's up to you at the end what, I don't know what else to say.
Motion.
I didn't make a motion.
You made a motion.
Yeah. Do I hear a second? Tell us this, Eric, I mean, how important is it that it's done this week? I mean, is it really... We're not like serious at the end yet, but when you get a couple emails from NDOT asking about your contract, and I know in the past Brown County's lost about $75,000 by not answering emails doing. I don't think they want it by tomorrow. I'm just saying I know how meetings work. I know how getting people together works. I need to get it signed soon.
Well, sounds like if we don't have today, it'll be October 16th when we meet again. And we need to approve this?
Yeah, I mean, I would like it approved before next meeting. If you guys sign, agree, whatever. I'm okay with what Ron said. I'm okay with whatever. Just, I need to move forward and get it done.
All I asked for was 24 hours. But you guys go ahead.
I mean, this is the final one with Aegis signatures. I did submit one.
Really, was that 2 weeks ago? Mm-hmm.
I think I emailed it a couple weeks ago. It just wasn't the final thing.
Right.
But then I once we got finished, and I said, okay, look, I need to go ahead and get a signed copy, so that way after you guys looked at it, it was the final deal. So it's now
legal.
Yep.
Yeah.
So from a legal standpoint,
it looks good.
Yeah.
Is that correct, Mr. Mogan?
You
got any muted, Laura?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Didn't have that here, boy?
Yeah. I've had one for a while.
Hey, Scott, I'm here now. What I was going to say, first of all, is you can always make the vote contingent on Ron's review of it and then have it signed in 24 hours. Similar to the way you do when you want me to review it but want to vote on it today. And then secondly, I believe this is the one, because I know that there was two contracts I reviewed for you, Eric. This is the one that I gave the thumbs up to, not the one that I need till Friday for?
Correct. This has nothing to do with the right-of-way stuff. This is our four-year contract.
Right, yep, so I have given the thumbs up on this one.
Does this look the same coverage as what we're using?
It's not. This will be, these guys, you know, when I first got here, this was one of the first meetings. We, you know, new packets came in. We went through NDOT's process with grading, rating, and this is the company that got picked in the end with ratings based off of the request.
USI does.
Correct, yeah. Yes.
Well, it's been through legal. It's probably a pretty spoiled thing. I didn't see anything that jumped out to me.
I mean, everything that is there is on NDOT's checklist of everything that needs to be submitted.
Well, they had a motion. I don't think we had a second.
Okay, so I'll make a motion. We go ahead and sign it now.
Okay. I hear a second. I'll second that motion. Let's get on with business.
Okay. And I have
a vote.
Oh, sorry.
Any discussion further? Hearing none. All in favor, raise your right hand and say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same time?
Nay. While you're here, Eric.
I got one more thing real quick.
Okay.
So I've had some calls from basically residents or HOA or Wyatt Manor on Wyatt Drive and Winslow Court off of Georgetown Road. They're trying to dismantle their HOA. They're wanting the county to take over those two sections of roads. They're basically two small roads, cul-de-sacs on each end. They're not wanting the county to pay any money for these. They're just trying to give us the responsibility. Mike's and Moga's in contact with, I guess they have a representative now that lives in that area. So he can explain a little bit how the process can work. Mike, if you would.
Hey. Yeah, so this is similar to what we did in June. With the Music Center Road, the county can accept the property because it's going to be for free. It's essentially a donation. We don't need to take this to the council for their approval. So ultimately, it would be up to the commissioners. We'll follow the state code guidelines. Nothing's been officially offered yet, so this is more of a heads up. And then when the final details come through, we'll make a presentation to the commissioners in a public meeting, and you guys can vote on it as you choose.
What would be the benefit to the county taking the roads? Mike?
Is that for Eric or for me?
For Eric.
So it's similar to what it was in June. Is when the county has more property, it means that they have more control over that property. So they can open it to the public and they can use it as they see best fit for the county. To the detriment is you're going to have to maintain that road, clearing out the snow and other things of that nature. So there is an additional cost whenever you accept additional property. And Eric, maybe you can add a little bit to that.
Yeah, I don't know the exact extent of it because I don't know what it actually would bring in like our other roads would, you know. And then we have to go out there and actually look at the road, walk it ourselves, and see what kind of shape the road is in. This is just the very beginning of this.
Okay.
So we're kind of going to look at it from all angles. I do know in the past, I've heard from my guys out the highway that they have plowed snow through there before to help them out. I don't know if it's a buddy deal, whatever. Me personally, I wouldn't mind to help. I'm just not comfortable putting a tandem axle dump truck, plow and spreader on a road that's not ours, and then tear it up, and then we've got the issue with our trucks poured up. You guys need to fix it. We're not collecting any money from it. So that's kind of where we're at, and we just need to see where this goes moving forward. So we'll try to get all the info we can.
What kind of mileage are you talking about?
I don't have it calculated. It's not Not very much. There's several houses on each section, but yeah, it's not a lot. It's right off of, if you go Georgetown from Hoover up the hill, right, you know, before you get to the blacktop, or maybe right after, turn north, it's that little subdivision right there.
Okay. I just have something that will take 60 seconds to bring it to your attention. Clay lick, I guess Dukes went out there and cleared the road where there's a creek, and it suggested that there be a guardrail put up.
Sandy and I talked about this.
Okay.
I've got the address to go.
All right. And now, up on Carmel Ridge and Lick Creek, can you zone in on that spot in your mind?
Maybe, yeah.
Carmel Ridge, it comes off 45 and runs all the way up. And then there's a little, what they call, short shoot. And then there's a Hazeltown Road. And when Carmel Ridge got blacktopped, because the name had been changed, they didn't run the asphalt on out to Lick Creek. Person was wanting to know if that's on the list to get paved at any point. It looks like it went up there and ditched it. Just so I can give them an answer. You don't have to give me an answer right now. You can take a look at it, figure it out.
Well, that, you know, like I said last meeting, with our Violetics and our new PASER ratings and all that stuff, and with our new asset management plan that's coming before December that we have to get submitted to LTAP, we'll kind of have a better idea where our five-year plan is.
Okay.
And we'll be able to actually put that out to public and kind of see where we're at from there.
Okay, that's good for the moment.
Okay. I don't really have anything else.
One other issue, I keep getting some communication from at least one party about the striping on Helmsburg Road where it makes that zigzag.
So I had a gentleman in the office yesterday. We had a nice chat with him. And I told him that we would reach out to a few contractors, see if we could get that straightened up and make that even through there. There's actually that spot, and just a little bit farther north, right at the curb, a bridge, I think there's another spot that we want to straighten up. Yeah. So yeah, we're looking at that too.
Okay.
Yeah, very good.
And real quick too, I'm constantly getting rave reviews on your work. You know, everybody's bragging on you and it's going good. We did have an individual or two that was concerned about, as could be expected, the dust.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I'm sure that's not an issue today.
Yeah. Right?
But do we have plans for the future when it gets this dusty to be able to do something with some dust control?
Plans, no, but we have kind of a work session going right now to see where we can get products from.
Okay.
The products that you can just go buy for that stuff is just, the cost for us is way too much for the gravel we have. It's more smaller residential. But we're looking at that to see if we can put it in cases where it's houses or, you know, business on gravel or, you know, something like that.
And it was a little inordinate stretch of driveway.
Yeah, I mean,
so, I mean it's been, yeah. But it happens once in a while. And so I do get the gist.
Yeah, we are looking at that. I spoke with another gentleman lives on Georgetown yesterday. And so he's.
Okay.
He's got an idea, and we're going to talk, and we're looking at it.
Thank you.
Darren, you got something real quick. 1 minute.
I can attest to the fact that Short Shoot is in horrible shape, and something needs to be done about it.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Hi, real quick question. Eric, I'm excited about Violetics coming in. When do you think you'll have your report?
Trent was the assistant. Trent was actually, I think we had 6 or 7 roads left of pavement to do. He was doing that, I think he started it today again. We still have our gravel roads to do, but we're just doing pavement right now.
Yeah.
And I think I should be able to get that info to Slater and stuff by the end of this week. Okay. And he's actually going to, we'll get started on the asset management plan. So I can actually, if you want to come down, I can show you the map and show you the pictures. And show
well
you
done, man. Thank you, man.
So it's pretty impressive.
Just getting the PASER scale done correctly will allow the county to have a good plan.
Yeah.
So thanks for that, Eric. Appreciate it.
And Eric, I just wanted to say that I'm really glad that I hired you. I'll be honest.
Taking all the credit.
I'll be honest with you. I wasn't sure whether you'd step up to the job or not. I didn't have the experience at that responsibility level. But I want to say I am really impressed how you've stepped up to the job. We've got a full crew down there working now. We haven't had that in 5 or 6 years. the police are way down. I mean, everybody's a lot happier. Your guys are happier. Things are going well. And I thank you for that.
I appreciate it. It's a learning process. And we're learning every day. I mean, I'm learning. My office manager's learning. The assistant's learning. It's every day something new. This federal stuff is new. So it's a learning process, but we're getting there.
Very good.
Thank you.
I entertain a motion.
5 seconds to Eric. 3 seconds. Our asphalt millings an opportunity for dust to keep the dust down in lieu of thick gravel? Yes, no?
Maybe.
Okay, thank you.
For
cheating.
Yeah.
Okay,
Motion to adjourn.
Here, second. Yeah. Been right into that. 5:04. Thank you all for coming.